Chapter 8. Did not want him to think that she regretted having told him her story. Poor creatures, he rejoined. Wonder why they came down to that fever hole. She laughed ironically. Oh, better themselves. It's worse up on the mountain. Bash Hyatt married the daughter of the farmer that used to own the brown house. That was him by the stove, I suppose. Harney seemed to find nothing to say, and she went on. I saw you take out a dollar to give to that poor woman. Why did you put it back? He reddened and leaned forward to flick a swamp fly from the horse's neck. Wasn't sure, was it, because you knew they were my folks and thought I'd be ashamed to see you give them money? He turned to her with eyes full of reproach. Charity, it was the first time he had ever called her by her name. Her misery welled over. I ain't ashamed. They're my people, and I ain't ashamed of them, she sobbed. My dear. Dot, he murmured, putting his arm about her, and she leaned against him and wept out her pain. It was too late to go around to Amblin, and all the stars were out in a clear sky when they reached the North Dormer Valley and drove up to the Red House. Via, since her reinstatement in Miss Hatchard's favor, Charity had not dared to curtail by a moment her hours of attendance at the library. She even made a point of arriving before the time, and showed a laudable indignation when the youngest target girl, who had been engaged to help in the cleaning and rearranging of the books, came trailing in late and neglected her task to peer through the window at the solace boy. Nevertheless, library day seemed more than ever irksome to Charity after her vivid hours of liberty, and she would have found it hard to set a good example to her subordinate if Lucius Harney had not been commissioned, before Miss Hatchard's departure, to examine with the local carpenter the best means of ventilating the immemorial. He was careful to prosecute this inquiry on the days when the library was open to the public, and Charity was therefore sure of spending part of the afternoon in his company. The target girl's presence, and the risk of being interrupted by some passerby suddenly smitten with a thirst for letters, restricted their intercourse to the exchange of commonplaces. But there was a fascination to Charity in the contrast between these public civilities and their secret intimacy. The day after their drive to the brown house was library day, and she sat at her desk working at the revised catalog, while the target girl, one eye on the window, chanted out the titles of a pile of books. Charity's thoughts were far away, in the dismal house by the swamp, and under the twilight sky during the long drive home, when Lucius Harney had consoled her with endearing words. That day, for the first time since he had been boarding with them, he had failed to appear as usual at the midday meal. No message had come to explain his absence, and Mr. Royal, who was more than usually taciturn, had betrayed no surprise and made no comment. In itself, this indifference was not particularly significant, for Mr. Royal, in common with most of his fellow citizens, had a way of accepting events passively, as if he had long since come to the conclusion that no one who lived in North Dormer could hope to modify them. But to Charity, in the reaction from her mood of passionate exultation, there was something disquieting in his silence. It was almost as if Lucius Harney had never had a part in their lives. Mr. Royal's imperturbable indifference seemed to relegate him to the domain of unreality. As she sat at work, she tried to shake off her disappointment at Harney's non-appearing. Some trifling incident had probably kept him from joining them at midday, but she was sure he must be eager to see her again, and that he would not want to wait till they met at supper, between Mr. Royal and Verena. She was wondering what his first words would be, and trying to devise a way of getting rid of the target girl before he came, when she heard steps outside, and he walked up the path with Mr. Miles. The clergyman from Hepburn seldom came to North Dormer except when he drove over to officiate at the old white church, which, by an unusual chance, happened to belong to the Episcopal Communion. He was a brisk, affable man, eager to make the most of the fact that a little nucleus of Hirsch people had survived in the sectarian wilderness, and resolved to undermine the influence of the gingerbread-colored Baptist chapel at the other end of the village. But he was kept busy by parochial work at Hepburn, where there were paper mills and saloons, and it was not often that he could spare time for North Dormer. Charity, who went to the White Church like all the best people in North Dormer, admired Mr. Miles, and had even, during the memorable trip to Nettleton, imagined herself married to a man who had such a straight nose, and such a beautiful way of speaking, and who lived in a brownstone rectory covered with Virginia creeper. It had been a shock to discover that the privilege was already enjoyed by a lady with crimped hair and a large baby. But the arrival of Lucius Harney had long since banished Mr. Miles from Charity's dreams, and as he walked up the path at Harney's side she saw him as he really was. A fat middle-aged man with a baldness showing under his clerical hat, and spectacles on his Grecian nose. She wondered what had called him to North Dormer on a weekday, and felt a little hurt that Harney should have brought him to the library. It presently appeared that his presence there was due to Miss Hatchard. He had been spending a few days at Springfield to fill a friend's pulpit, and had been consulted by Miss Hatchard as to young Harney's plan for ventilating the memorial. To lay hands on the Hatchard Ark was a grave matter, and Miss Hatchard, always full of scruples about her scruples, it was Harney's phrase, wished to have Mr. Miles' opinion before deciding. "I couldn't," Mr. Miles explained, "quite make out from your cousin what changes he wanted to make, and as the other trustees did not understand either, I thought I had better drive over and take a look, though I'm sure," he added, turning his friendly spectacles on the young man, "that no one could be more competent, but of course this spot has its peculiar sanctity. I hope a little fresh air won't desecrate it," Harney laughingly rejoined. And they walked to the other end of the library, while he set forth his idea to the rector. Mr. Miles had greeted the two girls with his usual friendliness, but Charity saw that he was occupied with other things, and she presently became aware, by the scraps of conversation drifting over to her, that he was still under the charm of his visit to Springfield, which appeared to have been full of agreeable incidents. "Ah, the co-persons. Yes, you know them, of course," she heard. "That's a fine old house. And Ned Cooperson has collected some really remarkable impressionist pictures. The names he cited were unknown to Charity. Yes, the Schieffer Quartet played at Lyric Hall on Saturday evening, and on Monday I had the privilege of hearing them again at the Towers. Beautifully done. Bach and Beethoven, a lawn party first. I saw Miss Belch several times, by the way. Looking extremely handsome." Charity dropped her pencil and forgot to listen to the target girl sing song. Why had Mr. Miles suddenly brought up Annabel Belch's name? "Oh, really?" she heard Harney rejoin, and, raising his stick, he pursued. "You see, my plan is to move these shelves away, and open a round window in this wall, on the axis of the one under the pediment. I suppose she'll be coming up here later, to stay with Miss Hatchard?" Mr. Miles went on, following on his train of thought, then, spinning about and tilting his head back. Yes, I see, I understand. That will give a draft without materially altering the look of things. I can see no objection." The discussion went on for some minutes, and gradually the two men moved back toward the desk. Mr. Miles stopped again, and looked thoughtfully at Charity. "Aren't you a little pale, my dear? Not overworking? Mr. Harney tells me you and Mamie are giving the library a thorough overhauling." He was always careful to remember his parishioners' Christian names, and at the right moment he bent his benignant spectacles on the target girl. Then he turned to Charity. "Don't take things hard, my dear. Don't take things hard. Come down and see Mrs. Miles and me someday at Hepburn," he said, pressing her hand and waving a farewell to Mamie Target. He went out of the library, and Arnie followed him. Charity thought she detected a look of constraint in Arnie's eyes. She fancied he did not want to be alone with her, and with a sudden pang she wondered if he repented the tender things he had said to her the night before. His words had been more fraternal than lover-like, but as he had lost their exact sense in the caressing warmth of his voice, he had made her feel that the fact of her being away from the mountain was only another reason for holding her close and soothing her with consolatory murmurs. And when the drive was over, and she got out of the buggy, tired, cold, and aching with emotion, she stepped as if the ground were a sunlit wave, and she the spray on its crest. Why, then, had his manner suddenly changed, and why did he leave the library with Mr. Miles? Her restless imagination fastened on the name of Annabel Balch. From the moment it had been mentioned, she fancied that Arnie's expression had altered. Annabel Balch at a garden party at Springfield, looking extremely handsome. Perhaps Mr. Miles had seen her there at the very moment when Charity and Arnie were sitting in the Hyatt's hovel, between a drunkard and a half-witted old woman. Charity did not know exactly what a garden party was, but her glimpse of the flower-etched lawns of Nettleton helped her to visualize the scene, and envious recollections of the LD things which Miss Balch avowedly wore out when she came to North Dormer made it only too easy to picture her in her splendor. Charity understood what associations the name must have called up, and felt the uselessness of struggling against the unseen influences in Arnie's life. When she came down from her room for supper, he was not there, and while she waited in the porch, she recalled the tone in which Mr. Royal had commented the day before on their early start. Mr. Royal sat at her side, his chair tilted back, his broad black boots with side elastics resting against the lower bar of the railings. His rumpled gray hair stood up above his forehead like the crest of an angry bird, and the leather brown of his veined cheeks was blotched with red. Charity knew that those red spots were the signs of a coming explosion. Suddenly he said, "Here's supper? Has Verena Marsh slipped up again on her soda biscuits?" Charity threw a startled glance at him. "Presume she's waiting for Mr. Arnie." "Mr. Arnie, is she? She'd better dish up, then." "He ain't coming." He stood up, walked to the door, and called out, in the pitch necessary to penetrate the old woman's tympanum, "Ed along with the supper, Verena." Charity was trembling with apprehension. Something had happened, she was sure of it now, and Mr. Royal knew what it was. But not for the world would she have gratified him by showing her anxiety. She took her usual place, and he seated himself opposite, and poured out a strong cup of tea, before passing her the teapot. Verena brought some scrambled eggs, and he piled his plate with them. "Ain't you going to take any?" he asked. Charity roused herself, and began to eat. The tone with which Mr. Royal had said he's not coming seemed to her full of an ominous satisfaction. She saw that he had suddenly begun to hate Lucius Arnie, and guessed herself to be the cause of this change of feeling. But as he had no means of finding out whether some act of hostility on his part had made the young man stay away, or whether he simply wished to avoid seeing her again after their drive back from the Brown house, she ate her supper with a studied show of indifference. But she knew that Mr. Royal was watching her, and that her agitation did not escape him. After supper she went up to her room. She heard Mr. Royal cross the passage, and presently the sounds below her window showed that he had returned to the porch. She seated herself on her bed, and began to struggle against the desire to go down and ask him what had happened. "Thee rather die than do it," she muttered to herself. With a word he could have relieved her uncertainty. But never would she gratify him by saying it. She rose and leaned out of the window. The twilight had deepened into night, and she watched the frail curve of the young moon dropping to the edge of the hills. Through the darkness she saw one or two figures moving down the road. But the evening was too cold for loitering, and presently the strollers disappeared. Lamps were beginning to show here and there in the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.